Charles Mingus's musicians called his jazz workshop the jazz sweatshop. Mingus would lash out at his musicians if they didn't play his music right. If he felt slighted by his players or fans, he would seek immediate retribution. Here is Gene Santoro, Mingus biographer and author of Myself When I'm Real.
People would come to see Mingus and his workshop perform live expecting something to happen, not just musical. His reputation was well enough established so that they would expect him to blow up or lecture the audience or lecture one of the people on the bandstand or maybe all three if they got really lucky that night. As Charles McPherson said to me, he wasn't happy even on a night when the music went perfectly. If he didn't get a chance to do one of his things on stage, it was like the performance was incomplete.
Alto saxophonist McPherson remembers when one of Mingus's most beloved musicians, Eric Dolphy, left the band.
I took Eric Dolphy's place because Eric had handed his 2 weeks' notice in. And Mingus was mad at it. He wanted to fight Eric. I mean, he wanted to actually beat Eric up because Eric was going to quit. And I can remember one at the end of one of the gigs. Mingus threatened him. He just, you know, you can't leave me. I'm all this music is hard. I got to teach it to somebody else. And you've been here, now you're gone, and now I got to start all over again. And you can't do it. I mean, he wanted to fight him. He wanted to cut him with a knife. And Eric is this very nice, calm man. And he told Mingus, he said, "Oh, Mingus, I don't have a knife." You know, and Mingus said, "Well, wait a minute. I'll go to the store over here and buy you one." He went over to the store, a little candy store, and bought him a knife and brought it back as if they're going to, like, you know, whittle on each other.
A week or so later, Mingus regretted his vicious attack. During a performance in Europe, Mingus renamed one of his compositions, "So Long, Eric." A few months later, Eric Dolphy died tragically in a diabetic coma. The day before the funeral, Mingus named his son Eric Dolphy Mingus. Occasionally, Mingus's anger was grounded in an unfair reality. Record companies continually cheated him from his royalty payments. In 1963, Mingus left a note for an Impulse record executive, stuck to the back of his chair with a knife. The note read, "Where the F is my money?" Signed Mingus in capital letters. His widow, Sue Mingus, preserves her husband's legacy and currently runs Revenge Records, a label devoted to the legitimate re-release of Mingus bootlegs. Sue declined to do an interview for this piece. She sees no relationship between the title of a record company and the character of her husband.
But no freedom.
Mingus's vengeance did more than win him his royalties and get him into fights. It reshaped American culture. Take the 1960 Newport Jazz Festival, for example. Mingus discovered promoter George Weem booked Benny Goodman and rock and roll acts above him for higher pay to draw on larger white audiences. In revolt, Mingus pulled his band from the lineup and created a counter-festival for the exact same time within walking distance of Ween's. He had drummer Max Roach, vocalist Abby Lincoln, and saxophonist Ornette Coleman. Nobody came to Mingus's Rebel Festival, but Mingus got his way. Here's biographer Gene Santoro.
2 years later, when George restarted the Newport Jazz Festival, one of the headliners was a guy named Charles Mingus. As George said to me, Charlie knew how to get attention. This is a guy who found out at an early age in some ways that the best way to get people's attention was to get up in their faces. And it worked for him, so why change it?
In 1957, Mingus got in the face of Governor Orville E. Faubus of Arkansas. The Supreme Court had recently ordered schools desegregated. Governor Faubus called up the National Guard to prevent black students from attending Little Rock Central High School. Mingus aimed to make a foolery of Faubus.
Fables of Phoebus, for example, where he does a satire of that whole sort of racist thing. You know, it's a very...
Ridiculous, Danny.
Governor!
Why is he so sick and ridiculous?
He won't forget. I was in his school.
Then he's a fool.
It's funny. It sounds like something between circus music and vaudeville music, very much on purpose. It's aiming its rage in a way that uses Mingus's humor to undercut his target and make them seem as ridiculous as they should be, because in Mingus's eyes, that's what that stuff all was.
He would certainly be at odds. Politically, musically, relationship-wise, I mean, the fight is on. I mean, there was a lot going on. You had all the civil rights things, the war, the Vietnam War was happening. That was there, and Mingus had things to say about all of it. You know, Lester Young says you just have to fight for your life.
That is something that I think is part of that quality that attracts people to his music, that edge, that feel for life is something that you feel when you listen to the beauty of his music, the way that the melodies work. I mean, it's all stuff that's operating on you without having to be a musicologist or a musician. You just sense that, the joy in the music. And yet, at the same time, there's this affirmation of himself in there. This is what I am. Take it. Or leave it. Understand it at the very least. And that's something that I think underlines Mingus's life and his art, both.
Mingus's psychologist wrote in the liner notes to The Black Saint and the Sinner Lady that Mingus is the black saint who suffers for his sins and those of mankind. A martyr. For most people in his life, Mingus's artistry transcended his behavior. The promoter George Wing came back to him in the end, as so many others did. They knew Mingus's music was bigger than all of them. For Studio 360, I'm Simon Rentner.